You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. There's no way he's not tapping his foot right now, okay? They're, for whatever reason, and they deny it, they love this song. So, so Joey, are you in denial that you love the song, or do you accept it, or how do you shake out in the spectrum of Top Gun phenomenon among fighter pilots?
Well, that's funny. Of course, I couldn't hear it, but,
what?
Let's see, Highway to the Danger Zone, is that what it was in the background there?
Yes.
Yeah. You know, I'm a big fan of Kenny Loggins. I actually met him in Mexico about a year ago, and he's a good dude.
Well, so now you're going to give us a personal connection and say that's what... Okay, so you see Top Gun, does that in any way, shape, or form, and be honest here, okay, be honest with yourself, most important. Do you, does that affect your decision to become a Marine aviator and ultimately a naval aviator?
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. I mean, guys make fun of the movie and poke, you know, a little bit of fun at each other for watching it, but whatever. I mean, think about the kid that watches professional football or baseball and they want to grow up to be a football player, a baseball player. I mean, there's no doubt it had an influence on our career choice.
Okay.
Unfortunately,
it
was with, yeah.
Okay.
I think Top Gun 2 is coming out.
It is. I saw, he just, tell me, like, the collective heartbeat of the F-18 community, and many other aviators, I might add as well, and a lot of fallen aviators skipped the beat, last month when Tom Cruise says, yeah, it's going to happen in the next couple years, Top Gun 2 is going to film. It's like, oh, my God, we've been waiting all these years. Now, Joey, how much of the dialogue of the movie can you quote? Be honest.
90%.
In a rare moment of candor, they admit to it, okay? Because it's there is, like, what, the code of the samurai where you're not really supposed to quote it among fighter pilots, okay? But they all know it by heart. It's ridiculous.
So. Well, it's an automatic $5 fine if you quote it in the presence of other fighter pilots. That's 100% true.
That's, you know what? That's why I used to introduce Rudy and Metro when we were in Afghanistan. I'd say, and these are air officers, Rudy and Metro, they're fighter pilots, right? which always got a howl out of most people. Because they love being fighter pilots, and then when you kind of do that and expose them, they're like, why do you say that? Like, you love being a fighter pilot, yes? Do you want other people to know? Yeah, but Mac, it's the way you say it. I'm like, oh, now we're going to play that? I didn't say it right? They're like, you know.
Yeah.
I'm like, all right. Joey Perrazzo is, which is one of the great Italian names of all time, by the way.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Oh, no. I mean, and there's no way that name could be Joseph Perrazzo or Joe Perrazzo. It's got to be Joey. So for those of you who haven't met him, F-18 pilot, got out as a major. And
yes.
So let's talk about a quick review of your bio. Born and raised where?
In Northridge, California, just north of Los Angeles.
Okay, so Nomar Garcia Parra went to Cal State Northridge, for those of you who are big Red Sox fans. And at Northridge, home of the big earthquake. Were you around for the earthquake?
I was, yeah. I was up in Northridge when it hit. It was pretty violent. I'll never forget that, for sure.
No, I've heard people talking about, like, the front door flew open, like, the house was, like, rolling like a... Like, I don't know, I'm like a ship at sea. Pretty crazy. How does the Marine Corps and flying get on your radar?
Yeah, I mean, joined up in early 90s. I think I went to boot camp January 92. And made a 22-year career of it. I did a commissioning program in the Marine Corps called MESEP, and went to USC, so stayed kind of close to home, and then went to flight school and flew Hornets for the last almost 14 years of my career, so I was pretty lucky to do that.
Okay, combat deployments were?
Yeah, two combat deployments. So it was 2005, 2007, Iraq and Afghanistan. Those were both on aircraft carriers. And like I said, we flew missions. In 2005, it was just Iraq, but in 2007, it was Afghanistan as well. So,
wow. So
yeah, we're working working with NATO forces, and there weren't any Marines on the ground back then, but
right.
Spec Ops guys and stuff. Yeah.
Off what ship?
In 05 was the Vinson, and then 07 was the Stennis. And I'm not sure. I mean, they're still out and about deploying right now.
Right.
But yeah, I think the Bush is what I read, where the pointed off the carrier engaged in action in Syria. The Bush is in the Mediterranean right now, from what I understand. I was always in either the Persian Gulf or the Arabian Sea for the most part.
Ah, not a med guy. Yeah, I'm not a med guy either. I've never been. I've been the other way, but never been to the med. Before we talk about the air-to-air stuff, but being a seagoing guy, probably like the rest of us, not only your thoughts and prayers, but kind of a bit of a head-scratcher looking at how a naval warship gets hit by a tanker in the middle of the night. Your thoughts on that? That's, you know, like the rest of us, scratching your head. How the hell does that happen?
Oh, man. I mean, it seems like it shouldn't happen. It seems almost nearly impossible, but, right. You know, Murphy's Law comes into effect there. I really don't know. All these sensors and radars on board these ships. Really what it comes down to is there's a guy driving, you know, there's a man in the box on the naval warship. There's a man in the box on the freighter. These are just two human beings that are prone to make mistakes, and yeah, these ships don't exactly turn on a dime, if you know what I'm saying. So
right.
Mistakes can happen. It's kind of tragic.
Well, you know, and especially if you've ever, you know, lived on one for any amount of time, you know, you see all the different people that are involved in not only the navigation of the ship, lookouts. We just had Josh Brooks on. He's a surface worker guy explaining, you know, all the different watches that get set up, the redundancy between the bridge and the CIC, you know,
sure.
all that stuff. And so I guess for those of us who've lived on ships and watched those guys in action, it seems impossible that it could happen. But as Josh said, you know, when these things happen, he said in the Navy they happen about every 15 to 20 years. And he said it's like a piece of Swiss cheese. All these things fail consecutively to get you to where you got, and it's not one failure, it is a series of them. And he said the investigation will bring that out. But you know, the other
Absolutely.
Thing he said was you know, if you can imagine, you know, and you can because you've been at sea, but sleeping at night and then all of a sudden, you know, something happened, the collision alarm, general quarters going off, setting condition zebra, all the things you hear, and you know, when they're doing their thing, you're doing it. The aviator is not too much slowed down by it, but the rest of the ship all incredibly affected by it. So you think about those guys trying to fight that, trying to save people, trying to stop the water from spreading in the ship, and with a gaping hole below the waterline. And probably an incredible rough night for those guys, but they saved the ship, got back under its own power, so pretty amazing.
That is amazing, and I've seen it in action. I mean, it's the aircraft carrier, there's over 5,000 sailors and Marines on it, and they all seem to kind of come together when needed and act as one, and that's exactly what happened on that ship. I mean, I guarantee you they all did their part in their own little way. To save that ship from further damage and probably save some more lives. So it's pretty remarkable to watch all of those pieces in action.
You know, after watching the news all weekend and the different things you read, you know, in the news that are just stupid, It's really great to have, you know, a surface warfare guy talk. And, you know, one of the things he said is, you know, when you're setting Zebra, you know, and, you know, so the hatch is closed. It's just that, that small circular scuttle that's the last thing open as you move in and out of berthing areas. And so, the decision to close that ultimately on those berthing areas, which housed probably 40, sailors apiece. And, mm-hmm. and he said, you know, probably the true story is it's really amazing that, you know, more people didn't die in those two compartments that were damaged and heavily damaged and that many got out, at night.
Yeah.
You know, in the dark and all of that. So anyway, in the last 24 hours, F-18, versus, SU-22. First of all, what version of the, F-18 was involved in this incident?
From what I read, it was a Super Hornet, an Echo, single seat Super Hornet off the bush in the Mediterranean. That just got released, I think, late last night.
All right. So tell us about single seat Super Hornet. Anything unique about the aircraft?
No, it's the same as the legacy Hornet that we've been flying for several decades. Probably a little bit upgraded radar. It's called AESA. I'm assuming that's what it has. But really, it's the same targeting system and missiles that we've been shooting for several decades with just improvements on them.
Okay, so talk to me about I got an email here that asks you a couple questions, so I'll steal from it. Actually, let me just read it. Mac, sure. I have two questions. What is the route that our aircraft take from the Med to get to Syria, Syrian airspace? Two, what is the configuration of their weapons as they take off? Is it standard to have an an air-to-air weapon on board when they take off? We've been dropping bombs for so long. It surprised me that somebody who's actually configured like this. I'm ignorant,
yeah.
So I'm interested to learn. So so what's the route to get there, and then how are you configured normally when you leave the flight deck?
Yeah, you know, as far as the route, I'm not sure. I think they might go through Turkey.
Okay, that would make sense, right?
Yeah. In terms of we call it loadout. Okay, so with the F-18, it's a very unique machine into where you could have both an air-to-ground and an air-to-air loadout at the same time. However, I really think that these airplanes that were involved in this probably had a pure air-to-air loadout, is my guess. And where we get the assignment for the loadout, what we're putting on the airplane, is usually assigned by what's called the ATO, or the Air Tasking Order. So we'll get that from higher command. And then what they'll do is they'll follow that air tasking order, and they'll go set up either some sort of air defense over a protected asset, or they might go, patrol. They could do close air support missions as well if they're configured properly. Or they can do all the above. They can get called into what's called on-call CAS or XCAS, close air support, and get brought in to, you know, help troops in contact situations. So very, very versatile aircraft. But my guess is that they were probably configured in such a way that would give them that air-to-air loadout and that air-to-air advantage over anything else flying. Good question.
The so let me pile on. Last week we shut down either a Syrian or a Hezbollah drone that had dropped ordnance. As this package is designed and published in the air tasking order, are there going to be certain F-18s that are configured to do CAS, and then certainly that are going to do what I would call combat air patrol? Because, you know, we're not going to go out. We're going to account for this because, truth be told, if this is the first one that got shot, I guarantee, you know, Joey, I mean, there's probably a series of incidents that have led to this, in terms of them getting close, them being warned, and then after they attacked today, then they got, or yesterday, there was an engagement. Can you talk about, does that configuration be split up? Would you have both on an aircraft? And normally, and talk about the, I guess, probably from the drone event, this thing escalating.
No, yeah. I mean, the pilots that are flying these missions are, they're doing what's on the air tasking order, but and there's a lot more that goes into the mission planning itself. In terms of understanding, you know, ROE and commander's intent. So that not only do they have to understand all that, but in addition to the, you know, mission at hand and what they're flying, the missiles they're going to be shooting, the tactics they're going to be using, the bombs they have on board, the people they're going to be talking to, on what frequency, on what radio. There's a lot of moving parts and a lot that goes into these missions, and they're very fluid. But here's what it comes down to, Mac, is that somebody ultimately gave those guys permission to fire. We call that a hostile declaration, okay? You have, once you receive that, the H word over the radio, you don't ask any questions. You're squeezing the trigger and you're targeting those aircraft on timeline. And missiles are coming downrange, okay? You'd never have a guy, in a cockpit that question a hostile declaration. Believe me, we're all salivating over this like a dog over a piece of steak, right? Probably the adrenaline's pumping and the hair on the back of his neck is standing up a little bit because he got that hostile declaration, which is what we've been practicing for all of these years. So, what I mean by this is that this came from higher. You know, there's no misinterpreting the ROE in this one. Somebody gave him a hostile declaration for him to be allowed to squeeze that trigger. And if you look at the series of events that's been unfolding, this is absolutely a escalation in force on our part. With the new regime, I'll call it regime, but the new, cabinet and that's in power now, Trump, especially with Mad Dog Mattis there kicking ass as, SecDef. These guys aren't messing around. And you know, Mac, that it's all about empowering your people, right?
Right.
And small unit leadership. And this is exactly what Mattis is doing. Trump trusts General Mattis, and he's clearly said that we will escalate force as needed, especially to protect our own, you know, U.S. Forces.
No, it's in my opinion, you know, it's about time. I mean, we've been restrained, and we allow these jackasses who can't hang with us, you know, to talk shit in public and all that. The next group that needs to get smoked is the Russians. You know, Putin needs his pants pulled down because they're not nearly all that. I mean, they've got stuff and they have capabilities and whatnot. But playing with the American air power is you better have your shit together or you're gonna get your ass smoked. A couple of emails. One, hey, Mac, what did Joey fly? So, Joey, what'd you fly? What version of the F-18?
I flew the F-18C, the Charlie model, single seat, and the D, the Delta model as well. A couple of A's and B's in there in the training command as well, A plus, and even an A++. So wow. These are all different versions of the Legacy Hornet. That unfortunately is no longer being produced, but is still flying and hanging in there. We'll see how long they last. But yeah, I flew all variants of the F-18.
The next email, Mac, could he walk us through the sequence of how you would engage an aircraft like the SU-22? Could he give us an American aircraft that the SU-22 would be akin to? Certainly we know that they're not as capable in terms of pilots' skills and whatnot, but what would the SU-22 be akin to in the American inventory? So, Joey, walk us through, first of all, the aircraft.
Yeah, sure. I'll start with the enemy. I mean, you always start there first, right? Start with the enemy and the target and work backwards. The SU-22... Russian-built Sukhoi fighter bomber. The thing's got to be the design and manufacturing of it, 50 years old. What I think is that the Assyrians maybe have, my guess, 20 or 30 of them that are still operating, but they're pretty beat down. This thing really has zero capability against our fighters. These are the workhorses, the backbone of their air force that they use to drop their bombs, mostly unguided, but they can fire some, from what I understand, precision-guided ordnance, as well as some rockets and gun. But really, in terms of air-to-air missiles, we don't have anything in our inventory that fights like that. I mean, okay. Maybe 50, 60 years ago, but it's wow. It's very fast, though. It can run away quicker than most other airplanes. It can go supersonic down low. It's designed for, you know, Mach 1 plus down low to ingress its way into the target and then egress out very fast. So, swept wing design, like the Tomcat, remember in Top Gun, how those wings can come out.
Right.
And then they can also fold back. So it kind of has a variable swept wing design. Now, in terms of, you want me to just keep going about our tactics? Shut me up. Okay.
No, I will. No, I won't, but keep going.
Okay, cool. So, the guys that fly off the carrier fall under Top Gun. You know, we joke about the movie, but it really is. They are the cornerstone of Navy fighter tactics for sure. And what they're doing there is they're flying a mission, probably, in my guess, it'd be some sort of, you know, what I call DCA or defensive counter air. So they're, like you said, they're setting up some sort of air patrol or maybe protecting an asset. My guess is that there's U.S.-backed troops on the ground that they're there to protect.
Right.
And believe me, we have multiple assets in theater that that just give this kind of super high SA, situational awareness, to these pilots. I mean, they're getting information through data link. They're getting information through other sources that come through the radios, the comm. But what they're doing is they're taking all that information and they're applying this to a tactic, a targeting tactic. So when they get that call to commit, we call it a commit, right?
Right.
You take a commit.
Okay, so hold on. Where are you? Are you loitering someplace? Have you checked on station?
Yeah,
you've checked on station. You've checked in with Rudy, and you said, hey, this is Viper 17. We've got I've got a section of F-18s with XYZ. So you've checked in and you're cutting holes in the sky, waiting to be tasked.
So what you're doing is not checking in with a JTAC. More than likely, unless you're doing some sort of air-to-ground mission,
okay.
You're probably checking in with some kind of airborne asset, like an AWACS or I don't know. It could be an E-2 control. It could be, a ground-based radar, but you're checking in with some sort of asset that's controlling the airspace. And you're checking in with them, and they're telling you where to go. And you're setting that cap and, basically flying circles in the sky waiting for somebody to tell you to take a commit or, intercept an escort or investigate something.
Okay, so the missions would be investigate, intercept, or what do you hear in your headset when you get told, to engage him or what?
What you do, see the way it's set up, and this is for defensive counter, there's many, many different ways that you can set up airspace, but my guess is that it was some sort of DCA mission in some area, some engagement zone that these fighters were responsible for.
Okay.
Now you could have multiple fighters out there in multiple engagement zones, we call them lanes, and if one of those enemy aircraft enters your lane or your area of engagement, then you take the commit, okay? What that airborne asset is going to do is they're going to call it a group of airplanes or a single airplane or whatever.
Got it.
Then you'll meet that commit criteria, and you'll go ahead and run an intercept on that target. There's various different types of tactics that you can use to run intercepts on these targets. But once you take that commit, somebody says the C word, then kind of all the attention goes to you, and everyone's focused on you in executing your tactics.
All right, so then what? So, what happens?
Yeah, sure. So what that looks like, and I mean, we'll take, I don't want to speak numbers here, but we'll take commits pretty far out, dozens and dozens of miles out, and we'll get our radar and all of our sensors downrange looking for that asset, as well as the airborne assets and all the other data link capabilities, all that stuff is coming into your cockpit. It's kind of molding it into this picture for you. We call it MSI, multi-source integration. track file, which gives us that kind of picture of what's going on out there. So you'll see the aircraft on your radar, on your sensors, and it'll be different shapes and colors, letting you know if it complies to ROE all electronically. You know, plus you have your radios, which are you're talking to these assets, letting you know if this is hostile or bogey or what have you, and getting as much information as you can. So you're running the commit, and then what it's ultimately up to is the guy in that cockpit is going to execute the tactic. Okay, so whatever got you to this point, it's still that pilot, that crew, that has to execute the proper tactic to engage this target, and that's exactly what he did.
All right. So what does he do? What does he do? I mean, how do you ever visually see the guy, or is this engagement going to take place at probably such a difference where you're never going to see him?
You know, it depends. If you are taking an engagement at range, you might be shooting AMRAAMs at him miles and miles away, and then running away, you know, and seeing if those missiles guide and fuse. Or if it's something that you have to investigate, a bogey, an unknown flyer, or what have you, you might go all the way to the merge with that guy, and that's where, you know, two fighters basically come to meet in the sky and then, you know, engage each other. That's called the merge.
Right.
You might be going to the merge and taking this guy out, you know, in the visual arena with an air-to-air, you know, heat seeker or something like that. So I don't know. They haven't released the tactic. My guess is that it was an AMRAAM shot that was fired at range, and that these guys watched the explosion and the track file disappear in their radar. That's just a guess for me, but that's a pretty sweet deal, man, I'll tell you. If you're that guy, I mean, we haven't shot one of those in over two decades, I think, so, or probably maybe close to 20 years.
Wow. The email, we've been shooting down, is it Fitters, F-I-T-T-E-R-S, since 1981. Bring out your fulcrum, bring out your fulcrums and your flankers.
Yeah, the MiG-29 and SU-27, I mean, those that's essentially what we train to, our tactics. So especially that SU-27, especially it has what we call the long burn threat, which is the extended range radar guided missile that was built by the Russians. So, but the Fitters, yeah, they got nothing, man. They a little, I think a little heat seeking missile on that thing, but that's about it. Yeah.
They're
sitting ducks.
That poor guy that gets sent on that mission, I mean, that had to be a hard gulp. Hey, we want you to head out there. And, hey, those pilots are not stupid. They've been watching this dance the whole time. We want you to drop, you know, against these guys in this area, you know, and they're supported by the Americans. Like, really? Are you sure you want me to do that? Right? I mean, come on. That's a death. That's possibly a death sentence, right?
Yeah, like kamikaze style. I mean, but I'll tell you what, you said it earlier, Mac, it's about time. That's my first thought was, it's about time. I mean, thank God, these people are evil. Dropping these barrel bombs on civilians and using chemical weapons on their own people, it's just, they're disgusting human beings. And, I just have to say it's about time. Thank God Mattis decided to ramp up operations over there, because
The other part of it is it's not with great fanfare either. And yeah. No announcement today, right? No big, nothing crazy. Yeah, we did that. Right? Yeah, we did that. We did that.
That's our style. Just to, you know, execute your tactic well and go on about your business.
Well, and you know what? Again, okay, here's another email. Mac, I'm curious what your guest's opinion is of the Soviet threat today, that any U.S.-led planes west of the Euphrates River are going to be targets. West of the Euphrates, okay? The Euphrates runs through Al-Anbar, right?
I know.
So that's a pretty big, that's a bold talk for a one-eyed fat man, as Rooster Cogburn said in True Grit. Do the Russians have that kind of capability to enforce that kind of big talk?
You know, I read that this morning too, and there's two things there. Number one is I think that they are forced to have some sort of verbal response. I mean, really, if they don't, they look like they're caught with their pants down, right? So they got to come back with some sort of verbal response. They did the same thing when we shot down the drone. They did the same thing when they fired 60 missiles at the Air Force base there in Syria. So,
hey,
and number
don't step over this red line. Hey, don't step over this red line. The keep going. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but no, you're right.
When they say targeted, what I think I read into that is that their weapon systems will be tracking or following our aircraft. So that's what I've read. I don't think they're going to actually. They're not going to pull the trigger. They might get their radars looking at us and tickle our radar warning receivers a little bit, but that's just going to get our pilots pissed off and want to do some damage. So.
Well, trust me, knowing the current Secretary of Defense and the instructions, I think General Dunford was on the news late last week, and they said, what's been the biggest change in the last 90 days relative to the CENTCOM AO? He said, well, I think the biggest change you would have to say is General Mattis adjusting our orders from to defeat to annihilate. And it's like you hear somebody as composed as Joe Dunford using the word annihilate, and he said that would probably be the biggest adjustment. And you're like,
yeah.
Holy shit, man. If I was on the other side hearing that word, these guys, that would make me uncomfortable. And again, let's talk about this. In terms of hostile act as an aviator, they paint you with a weapons. Talk to me about that whole sequence. You can be painted. Is that a hostile act? And then is the sequence, I'm painted, somebody locks on to me and I detect that, and then somebody launches. So walk us through the sequence, and when does it cross the line that we would launch, we would annihilate their anti-air system?
Yeah, sure. You know, we have, ROE is ROE. I mean, it's always going to change, but what we have on board our aircraft are sensors that can tell if there's some sort of search radar that's just out there looking at stuff, if there's some sort of tracking radar that's looking at us, and then we have also the ability to figure out if somebody's actually shooting at us. So using these different algorithms, and it can tell what's looking at it. The aircraft can tell what's looking at it. So, yeah, if we're getting shot at and our raw gear is going critical, you know, radar warning receiver is going critical, you pretty much consider that a hostile act. Now, whether a tracking radar that's locked onto us is considered a hostile act, like I said, that totally depends on ROE and who's calling the shots. My opinion is right now, just being tracked is not hostile, but you never know. That could change in the future.
Is there a difference between being tracked and being locked on in terms of the way you guys talk about it?
No. When a radar system locks onto us, it's essentially tracking us.
Okay.
And like I said, you can tell in your cockpit if something, the difference between something tracking you, something just looking around, something tracking you, and something shooting at you. So, yeah.
You essentially know if
there's a missile in the air that's guiding against you. So, and then we have our own, you know, tactics and ways to defeat those missiles and stuff. But,
my guess this morning, is the one and only F-18. How many different configurations, Joey?
I flew all four variants with several configuration changes in between them. So A through D, basically.
All right, Joey Perrazzo. One of the things that Joey, one of the ways we met, and one of the things that he's been on the program talking about is a program that he founded, and it's one of the cooler things that there's a whole lot of things that we've done over the course of our first year that have been pretty cool, and different people we brought on, but Warrior Passion is certainly one of them. So give us an update. What's new at Warrior Passion there, Killer?
Oh yeah, thanks, Mac. By the way, congratulations on your first year. I mean, I was going through last night a lot of those podcasts, and there's just such a wealth and just amazing information awesome. That you have stored on those things. I can't go back. I can't wait to go back and just listen to some of those. So
right. No,
congratulations, brother.
No, I'll tell you what. From squad leaders on Iwo Jima, Cal Humphrey to gender integration in the Marine Corps, to General Zinni, to Staff Sergeant Charlie Linville, who went to the top of Mount Everest, to probably the best interview I've ever done, maybe in my life, is with Staff Sergeant Jeremiah Workman, who was a recipient of the Navy Cross in Fallujah, and just bares his soul about what it's like to live with the burden of your Marines being killed, and then post-traumatic stress, and then trying to turn that into something positive, and his story, and the candor, and so... Thank you, man. Thank you. But it's stories like that you come on and tell about your passion to help guys and sticking your hand out the way you've done with Warrior Passion. So what have you and the rest of the you're a USC guy?
Yeah, USC.
Whoa, why? That's like 99. Totally doesn't compute. You sound like a Cal State Northridge guy. You don't sound like a University of Spoiled Children guy. What the hell? So you know what? I'll tell you, it gives me hope. It gives me hope that maybe there's going to be something different that comes out of that school of snobs. So talk to us, you and the adrenaline junkies at Warrior Passion. What are you up to?
Yeah.
What are you up to these days?
Awesome, man. Thanks for letting me talk about that for a minute. Yeah, we are just having a blast. Mac, it's growing. I'm trying to keep up with it, and we have a community of veterans now that's just so amazing and special. We've been going now for about a year and doing just getting together as a community, and really it's all about having fun and relying on each other for that community. Some of the specific things we've been doing this year, a lot of shooting events. So we'll take these guys out on a private ranch and go tear it up with some pretty cool weapons.
right. You know, hey, guns are fun. Right?
That's good. Yeah. Yep. Of course, I've got the plane, man. I own a Super Decathlon, little sport aerobatic plane. I'll tell you what, I put a smile on his face from these guys' face from year to year every time I take them up. So I'm just happy to keep doing that. And, these guys call me. They all call me. They want to go flying. Because I think I'm the only charity that's doing that, taking these guys out flying, so I'm going to continue doing that. One cool thing also is we sponsored a veteran race truck team. These guys built the most amazing dirt racing truck I've ever seen. I mean, in their shop, in their garage, and they're competing on the circuit with it now and doing races all year round in Lucas Oil Series and stuff, and this thing's amazing. They're called Infidel Motorsports, Team Infidel Motorsports. I think you can look them up on Instagram, but shout out to those guys.
Let me write it down. We'll get them on, and we'll talk about Team Infidel.
Dude, awesome. I think they're listening right now, so they'd be happy to come on anytime.
No,
yeah, Team Infidel Motorsports.
Love that stuff. Talk to everybody about the premise of your organization, because, you know, when Kurt Knowles, our buddy Rudy, first told me about it, I was like, that's so cool. But Warrior Passion, talk to us about, you know, the whole premise behind it.
Yeah. I mean, it started in 2005 in my mind when we lost two of our aviators in my squadron. One of them was my XO, and the other one was my roommate. John Spar and Kelly Hines, two just great, great guys. And they collided over the skies of Iraq, and neither of them survived the collision or ejection, so... how it kind of came together is, you know, that was such a rough, rough, dark time. When you lose Marines, your buddies that you're there fighting with, you know, by your side, like brothers, and you lose them, how do you get through it? You know, what you do is you get together, you band together, and you help each other get through it. And I realized that that's our community, you know, that we help each other get through those rough times with each other. That's where it kind of the idea spawned, and I figured, you know, how do we, after we get out of the military and we take that uniform off, we were so passionate about our job for so many years that you probably just don't hang up that uniform and it goes away. So I wanted to not only bring guys together as a community, but also wanted to help them individually get together and find their own passion through whatever it is, a sport, a hobby, an activity, something. To where they could enjoy that and really sink their teeth into it, but also enjoy it with the camaraderie of other veterans. So we're 100% veteran-based, owned and operated, and none of us take any salaries, man. We just get together and have a good time. That's what it's all about.
Got it. And so connecting guys to Adrenaline and each other, and then hopefully I know who I had somebody on, and God, I wish I could remember. But it's that a lot of times that jump start is what gets guys who are stuck kind of on the couch you know what I mean, in kind of a dark place, reconnecting them not only to their tribe but also to that adrenaline that they love. And that passion ultimately is the thing that jumpstarts it.
No, I love that word jumpstart. And that's what I've seen, Mac, is kind of this call it a graduation process. You remember when you were the new guy, you checked into a unit, and you were just big eyes and big ears, little mouth, and you just kind of looked around. And then a few months later or a year later, you're the mentor. You're the guy that's
come on, Joe. Come on, Joey. I was a new guy for maybe 7 hours in my life.
Yeah, it's funny. Is you're the new guy. Even as a fighter pilot, you're the FNG, man. As soon as you check in,
right?
Stand by for the worst of the worst.
Right.
Yeah, I've seen that also with this with the organization. Is this kind of graduating process where these guys want to step up and become mentors? I think that's been also a huge thing for them as well. So it's just kind of cool to watch that. Got a lot of guys that are getting involved with us now. In fact, I just went to a concert with one last night. Saw Boston, man. Oh, you would love it.
Listen, this is work somehow. What am I missing in all this, Joey?
Like I said, I'll tell you what, we just get together and have fun. That's what it's all about. No.
And then get out of the way, right? Because everything else takes care. I mean, look, everything else doesn't take care of itself. It's a lot of hard work, but it's reconnecting to that tribe. Right? You're not alone, man. We're still here. We still need each other. We still need to be tied into each other, and we can do this. So it's very cool.
Yeah.
How do people interested find you? Find Warrior Passion?
Yeah. Either through the website, it's warriorpassion.org, or through my Facebook page, just search for Warrior Passion, and I'll pop up there. We got a lot of cool events coming up, man, for the rest of the year, so I'm stoked to be able to do those here in SoCal, but we're always looking for ways to expand. So if there's somebody out there that is in another state or city that wants to kind of be like a hub for us and do a couple events, it doesn't have to be anything crazy. Hey, man, you like to go off-roading? Let's take a few guys off-roading. You like to go shooting, hunting, whatever, fishing? Well, get in touch with me on warriorpassion.org. I'm going to give my email out there, too, real quick.
Yeah, go
it's
ahead.
Easy. It's Joe, J-O-E, at warriorpassion.org. They can find me through my email as well. So, yeah, right. Super, super stoked to have anyone involved that wants to get involved, and we're gonna try to grow this thing. And like I said, just keep on having fun and become a bigger community.
Okay, one more email before I let you go. And again, my guest this morning here on a Monday edition, very graciously, is Joey Perrazzo, a retired major in the United States Marine Corps and former F-18. A through Z pilot, and we're talking about the engagement where an F-18 flying out of the med engaged an SU-22 and downed it, pilot, I guess, by a Syrian pilot, and then the Russian admonition to the United States that anything flying west of the Euphrates will be treated as a target. The email says this. Mac, I'm curious about the difficulty factor of both of these events. One, dealing with the SU-22 doesn't sound to be terribly problematic for the F-18, and in particular, the way that we're organized to fight in the air. He alluded to being tasked by either an AWACS or some aerial platform. So difficulty in downing that is the first question. Second part of my question is difficulty that the Russians pose. Are they that much of a threat to us? I, like you, have seen our Air Force, our Navy, and our Marine pilots fly through a lot of stuff. Our level of sophistication, our level of experience, are unparalleled on this planet. I don't know the Russians can hang with us. I'm curious about what your guest has to say. I've enjoyed both segments this morning very much. Keep up the good work. Congratulations on your first year. So, Perrazzo, level of difficulty factor. What is it?
Yeah, with issue 22, on a scale of 1 to 10, about a 1, maybe a 2.
That poor guy.
The difficult.
I mean,
the
honestly.
The difficult part. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Not even a sporting chance that guy had.
Not even a sporting chance. I mean, the only difficult part is making sure that we adhere to ROE. And,
right.
And from what I understand, is they gave those guys a few warnings.
Right.
Some shows of force saying back off. And,
right. And I guess we pick up the phone and called the Russians and said, hey, get this guy out of here now. Or I guess when he was getting ready to drop or looked like he was going to fly that profile, they said, tell him he does not want to do this. And the Russians were like, what? What do you say? No entiendo, you know. So, yeah, I don't know that the Russians speak Spanish, but it was some variation of that, I guarantee you. And now the Russians have said they're not going to answer that phone anymore. Like, well, okay, you might want to, because the next one might be coming through the phone, so be careful. So, anyway,
yeah.
Go ahead.
That whole thing is just confusing to me. A hotline? Letting them know that we're engaging. It's just weird. I've never heard of that type of warfare. But
right.
In terms of the Russian threat, man, I'll tell you what. If I had a crystal ball, I'd probably be higher into the higher levels. But that's way above, you know, basically our pay grade. I don't know how the Russians are going to react here, but if they react, they're going to be met with overwhelming force. I mean, no other, you know, force in the world has, what do we have, 10 or 11 carrier battle groups that can be called up on a moment's notice, you know, with tens of thousands of pre-positioned troops all over the world. I mean, these guys are 40, 50 years behind us, if they'll ever catch up. So I'm not too worried about that in the global picture, you know, the big picture stuff, but like I said, if I had a crystal ball and I knew the way the Russians were going to react, I'd probably be getting paid a lot more money right now.
Well, I mean, just my opinion. Vladimir Putin is one of the great bluff artists that's on the planet right now. His military can't cash the checks that he writes.
That's correct.
And we have stood there with our hands in our pockets, both in Europe, in the Ukraine. Why we're afraid of him is beyond me. And he needs to have his pants pulled down for the planet. So that they can, the planet can see that this guy ain't all that. He's with great bravado and all that. And I realize we might get a bloody nose in doing it, but you know, up is still up and down is still down. But it's not if you don't make it that way. If you allow somebody else to point sideways and say, no, that direction is up, and that's what Putin does, then I guess that he can define it for you. But I think we have the people, hopefully, that will make up be up and down be down, and we'll see what happens. But anyway.
Yeah, one last word. I mean, sure. What really kind of, you know, chaps my hide here is that this is really about Iran as well, because without money from Tehran and their sponsorship of the Assad regime, they don't have those SU-22s to fly. They were toast, man. They were rust buckets, and then they got a huge injection of money from Tehran to rebuild their air force and supply them bombs. Be able to do what they're doing now, and it's just that. So this isn't just about Russia, this is also about Iran. But if you remember not too long ago, we gave them pallets of billions of dollars, which was a disaster. So I don't understand any of that. But so if Russia is going to get a black eye, if Russia is going to get a black eye out of this, I hope that Iran gets knocked out for the, you know, down for the count for good.
I hope their day's coming that they get put in their box, because, again, and I saw General Mattis get interviewed, Secretary Mattis get interviewed and said, do you know what Russia is after? And he said, I have no idea. He said, clearly, the future of Russia lies in a close economic relationship with Europe. He said, that's in their best interest. Why they continue to destabilize the Western nations, or the Eastern nations of NATO and Europe, he said, is a mystery to me. At some point, they're going to have to make peace, and then that that piece and then the integration of their economy into the Western economy is what will make Russia a great nation again. He said, not this other nonsense. Yeah. He said, so I don't understand. And so pretty interesting. All right.
It is, yeah.
Joey, first of all, thank you for hopping on and doing this. He's the president of Warrior Passion, former F-18 pilot, and on occasion a F-18 explainer of things here on All Marine Radio. Mm-hmm. Thanks for the visit, bud.
Hey, Mac. Thanks for having me on, and congratulations on your first year. Talk to you soon, brother.
All right. Anytime, man. Let me know. And I tell the boys from Team Infidel that actually, could you send me their contact info, and I'll give them a call?
Yep, absolutely. You want it today, or you?
Yeah. Send it today. I'll give them a call today.
You got it?
All right, man. Thanks.
I'll do it right now.
There you have it.
All right, cheers, brother.
You bet. That is Joey Perrazzo, F-18 pilot. We're going to take a quick break. The Gunner joins us next here on a Monday edition of All Marine Radio, right here on the All Warrior Radio Network. This hour of All Marine Radio is brought to you by our friends at Battle Mug, home of the world-famous Battle Mug. Starts with 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at BattleMug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out. BattleMug.com.